They're setting up the projector for me, but we can go ahead and get started so I can keep on time. Thanks for coming. I appreciate that. We were talking before class, so I want to take an informal poll. I'm curious, how many people live within walking distance of campus? You see, you're learning. Okay, let's say 1 mile. What is a long walk for students these days? Half a mile? How long is a 30-minute walk for you? See, this is good. We're discussing design constraints here. Okay, so let's say, how many people live within half a mile of campus and walk? Raise your hands high. I'm curious. Okay, not too many. That's about what people were predicting. How many people drove to school today? Okay, and how many people took the train or other?
Exactly.
Excellent. Hey, excellent.
I ripped right in.
Okay. Interesting. The buses got canceled. Yep. So what's the next big deadline? What's due next? What was due this week?
Sledding at 4:00.
What was due this week? Revised abstract and revised problem statement. And what's due next week? And the narrative, right? And what's your sort of next big deadline?
15th of February.
Which is your hardware. How many people have set up appointments with their course coordinators for that? Okay, so don't leave that to the last minute, because the slots on Friday of that week at 5:00 are going to go pretty quickly. So, you know, if you don't want to be left doing your demo on Monday, first thing, which I'm sure, you know, is going to be tight, get with your advisor and course coordinator and set that time sometime this week so you can negotiate a pretty decent time. Any other business issues? You should now probably be in the lab. How many of you have staked out a position in the lab for your project? Good, okay. I hope by now, you know, you should be in the lab if you're planning on using lab facilities. So the different departments deal with that differently, but one way or the other, we should get you the appropriate lab space. I just need to be on the internet. As long as I'm on the internet, I'll be fine. Any other issues or business questions? Everything's humming along. No complaints. No. All right, good. So what I wanted to do today is to go through the design document for the last time, hopefully, and just make sure that everybody understands what's expected in each one of the sections, particularly the approach section. I want to talk a little bit about approach. But also the main thing I want to do today is give you a chance to ask me questions about Microsoft Word, since I know some of the teams wanted some pointers on Word, and we're having trouble with some issues of the design document. So as soon as we, looks like we're up here, let me bring up the design document template. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so next week, so on the first of next week, the design constraints and design constraints narrative are due. And then the following week is the approach. So we really need to spend some time today making sure you understand what's expected in both of these sections. Oh, you're in. Okay, perfect. Would you like to take over? Okay. So Dr. Cohen is here to give you what might be the third version of this, right? Because did you do this in seminar way back when?
No.
With them?
At least version two.
At least version two. I'll let you wherever you're at. And it's his favorite topic. It's also my favorite topic. Please, Dr. Cohen.
I guess there aren't a lot of liars
here. We can put this guy on, I think, if you want.
So, from my point of view, about almost a third of your grade was your design document, and
I'm sorry, do you need...
I assume you recognize this.
Oh, is it a jump drive?
Yeah.
Oh, really? That should be it, yeah.
Sure, I think there's another one down here.
This guy doesn't seem to be on for some reason.
No, it doesn't. Oh. It's all right.
Okay.
So, anyhow, back to my summer vacation, a favorite topic. How does this relate to your project? Well, I read 10 of your reports last semester. The ones who are assigned to the coordinator. And I can't speak for a whole lot of, for too much in the way of the other reports, but the reports that I read, most of them sounded a lot like my summer vacation presentation. When I got to the design, colored section.
Approach or design constraints?
Yeah, design approach. Okay.
Oh, well, I'm not having any luck here.
So you all remember this, or most of you probably remember this. And think how much more wonderful this would have been if I had left out the map. So two or three of you managed with the map to figure out where I was going for some of the things I was trying to do. But without the map, would anyone have even had a clue what I was doing? what I was trying to tell you. And that, but that's what many, most of your design approaches were like. Of the ten reports that I read, only two or three of them had the block diagram. Well, that's the map, right? Most of them just started in with, we're going to go southwest, and then we're 2/10 of a mile, and then we did left for 6/10 of a mile, and then we went west for 1/10 of a mile, and then we went straight for half a mile. So number one, there was no big picture. Number two, who cares what all the little steps were? Certainly an engineer who's reading this doesn't care. Maybe if it's necessary to be able to replicate what was done, you might want to put it into an appendix, the procedures into an appendix, so that somebody could replicate a particular type of experiment or a particular type of procedure. But to actually say, in order to mix concrete, we took 7 gallons of water and 15 pounds of aggregate and 5 pounds of cement and mixed them all together for 20 minutes. Really? Is that necessary to make cement? To tell somebody how you're going to make cement when it's very well published? This is very well known. It's only when you're doing something non-standard that you really, really need to lay it out in great detail if it's going to make a difference. So what are we looking for? We're looking for the block diagram and the tasks that you did, but not all the details of the tasks. So the block diagram lays out what? The block diagram lays out how you are getting from these goals to the product. And presumably those arrows and lines in the block diagram are the tasks. Right? So yes, you got to talk. So my ideal idea of an approach section is to start with, we came up with this block diagram, which gives us this list of tasks, and now we'll have sections of this approach, which talk about what it was about these tasks. Not necessarily I did this task, and then this task, and then this task, because really, who cares? And, unless it matters to the overall result, people multitask, teams multitask, it usually doesn't matter what order people did things in. So this task required us to do this, and that, to solve these particular equations, or do this particular process on the computer, or create such and such or a device, and then this task we tested it and we got these results. But you don't have to step by step. It doesn't add to the picture. It doesn't add to the overall thing. It detracts from the overall because it keeps the the reader trying to figure out, distracted with trying to figure out why this is relevant. And you're distracting the reader from the picture you're trying to paint, which is, these are the things which are important, and it all goes together like this. So, if you're disappointed in that grade for your report, that's why. That's mostly the reason why, is that people gave me the directions rather than the results and the reasoning. Okay, now if you need to tell me that we took this route instead of that route, and there are reasons for that, that's important. That's an important thing. But the details of this route and versus the details of that route usually aren't so important. And the step-by-step for this, for the route you took, aren't usually important. It's why did I take this route? Now, what did I find when I got to the end of the route? Not how did I get there? Any questions? Comments?
There's never any questions either.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
All right, so maybe if I could add one thing to this. What does the term revisionist history mean? When a writer is accused of writing revisionist history, what does that mean? Revisionist history of the Vietnam War, right? Very popular topic. What does that mean? Falsifying information. Not quite. Well, all history accounts are biased, it turns out. How does the term revisionist history apply to your senior design documents? Revisionist history, that term, is a thing when we talk about rewriting your design documents. Now, and that's essentially one of the things Dr. Cohen's trying to bring across. Why is that?
Make our intent what we ended up with. Make it seem like that's what we were trying to get from the beginning.
Right, close, right. I mean, too often the design documents become an attempt on your part to convince us that you were really busy and you worked really hard. And they literally tell us all sorts of gory details that don't make any sense put together. What we want is revisionist history, which means we want you to look back and describe all this as a coherent project. That's really where we got into trouble with these approach sections. They were just all over the place. It wasn't clear what the progression of thought was through that section. So the design document is not supposed to be an account of how busy you were, how hard you worked. It's supposed to be a well-written description of your project, good analysis, make everything fit together. If you worked on some things and it turns out that was a dead end and that just you didn't learn anything from that, it doesn't go in the design document. It should be a story that goes from beginning to end, a very coherent story. We'll come back to the block diagram issues. Too many of you eliminate. I thought it was kind of obvious having you do a block diagram that would be in your design document. I forgot to mention that you need to do that. Same thing with the cost analysis. A number of documents didn't have a section described, including their cost analysis that was done as a weekly assignment. So let's talk, let's kind of go through the document. So anybody have any questions on the cover page? And questions can be either word questions or content questions. This is our last joint meeting to discuss the design document. Everyone's 100% compliant on the cover page. What are the essential things that you need on the cover page? You need the title. Title must match what's on your website. You need the names of the team members, the advisor, and such. And you need a picture that tells us something about your project.
And May 12th as a date?
Yeah, you can use May 12th. You can use the, or May, whatever the due date of the document is. Any questions about that? Everyone's okay? Yes? So I'm going to show you now a trick that Joe Janowski showed me. I thought I was a power user, and I didn't even know about this trick until about 3 months ago. And this is like the most useful trick in Word, in my opinion, which is this thing. What does this little thing do? Copy the format. So what you can do is you can select something, copy its format, and paste it. And voila, the new thing gets that format. Now, why does that answer your question?
Copy the format as a template.
Exactly. I don't know. You know, I made this document probably 20 years ago. I don't know. I mean, I don't. The point is, I don't know what the font is. I haven't looked at the details of this document in years because I've been using Times 11 fonts forever. So whenever you have questions about formatting, don't turn this into a research project, just copy the format out of the document. In fact, start with editing the document. I think this semester, the Senior Design 1 teams are finally getting that, and they're actually starting with the template. Also, when you turn your documents in every week, give us the whole thing. Don't cut stuff out. Just, we're only going to look at the parts we're grading. We ignore the other stuff. But the point is, you're continually editing this document. We don't want you generating different versions of it or pieces of it or any of that kind of stuff. Most of the text here is Times 11, which is what the document uses overall. I think this is, if you swipe this, you can always look at the format. That's Helvetica 14. I'm a little bit lenient on the cover page, as I mentioned, if you want to get a little bit artistic, but you've got to have some the information that's here because it all kind of serves a point. Okay, on the second page, we have this information. Any questions on this? This goes, I cut and paste this into the abstracts booklet. So I do not want any, you know, deviations. I mean, we need that to be put in exactly as it's shown. How many words is your abstract? How do we count the words on this abstract? Well, how do we count the words? What? How?
Just highlight it and it's down to the bottom left.
Thank you. Is this, you guys are Team 16, right?
No?
No?
Team?
No.
That's Team 1.
No,
I'm number 1.
Okay, any questions on this? You know, I know everyone's sitting there laughing. This is stupid. We're wasting time on this. But why do, you know, we keep getting documents that don't conform to these things. And we try, you know, we try not to be difficult about this, but our patience at this point of senior design wears pretty thin on these kinds of issues. So the grading's going to be tough this semester. Executive summary. What's the number one most common mistake on the executive summary?
Must be one page long exactly.
Yeah, that actually is the most common mistake. So what does that mean in terms of this template that's provided? What should the first line on the executive summary be?
Executive summary.
There are a number of executive summaries that do not have this line at the top of their executive summary. How am I supposed to know it's an executive summary if that line is not there? Also, it must have the exact, you know, as a simple example of the formatting issues we deal with, the space between this title and this line is not a blank line. You'll notice if you put the cursor here, the cursor does not go there. Why?
Magic.
No, it's not magic. If you go under this little menu here, you go to the line spacing menu. If you notice, after this paragraph format has programmed into it one essentially one line, a 12-point line, after it. And that's what's used to space this from the first paragraph. Now, getting back to Rodney's comment about the why aren't these exactly one page? I get some which are exactly one page, so the authors think. And what happens when I go and apply the formatting rules to them?
To get too big or too small.
Right. Yes.
So how are we going to, because this is not one page, so how are we going to copy the format?
Okay. If I start adding paragraphs, if I start typing over this paragraph, obviously it'll stay in that format, right? If I hit go to the end of this paragraph and I hit return, what's the format of this paragraph?
Same as before.
So
this is okay.
What is okay? This is the format. This paragraph format, if you'll notice, if you go under styles, it's called normal SD normal. What does SD normal mean? Senior design. What does normal mean? Normal. That means that should be your default text paragraph format. What does that paragraph format look like? Well, you go to your line spacing options. You see it's got programmed in a blank line after the paragraph. Single line spacing. The font is Times New Roman 11. How many documents you think used Times 11 font throughout? No. How many documents do you think switch magically between one font and another somewhere in the document, particularly in the sections that are due later in the semester? Many. What does that tell us as readers when we're looking for something to really nail you on? That's like a big red flag. Why? It's easy to find, but why is that a big red flag? What does that mean has happened?
The team fell off.
In what sense? More.
No attention to detail. They're proud of the project.
Okay, well, let's not get too negative here. They're just trying to get on my good side here. No, what does that tell you if you're you know, a reader of this document? It tells you that obviously, more than likely, somebody else, there was a change in writers from that previous section to that section. And it also tells you that it's probably not been proofread. So you would be surprised in many of your documents, you know, there's glowing text. You'd swear James Joyce or somebody wrote this stuff, and then all of a sudden it switches. It switches font, it switches spacing, and the next paragraph is like grammar error left and right. And you, when you scan the documents, you find this stuff in like 2 seconds. So it may not stick out for you, but believe me, from our point of view, it sticks out. But, you know, that's very easy to do. You can take a set of text, you can copy the format, and you can just swipe it. And voila, it all has the same format now. So you can literally run this over all of your text and have your paragraphs get the right format. 2 seconds. Maybe 20 seconds if you're doing your whole document. So these, you know, these things are not that difficult. And I think oftentimes you make them more difficult because maybe you're afraid to ask for help on some of the word issues or something. One page, strict one page for the executive summary. How many paragraphs typically?
Four.
4 to 5 paragraphs. And we lay out sort of what's supposed to be in each one of those. Now, I know for a long time you've been telling me we can't write these executive summaries because our projects aren't finished. Well, that comes to an end this semester. And I think the executive summary is due towards the end of this semester. I think around the time of the final presentation. So What am I expecting to see in the, after I get past all the easy stuff, what's the next thing I look for in the executive summary? What if I get an executive summary that's all text? All letters, alphabet, letters, text. What does that tell me?
There's no numbers in it.
Okay, and what does that tell me? Tells me there's problems. You cannot, for almost all the projects in this room, you cannot write an executive summary without putting numbers in it. What kind of numbers am I looking for?
Testing results.
I want to see percentages, improvements. I want to see, you know, performance levels. I want to see some hard numbers. Again, you can scan these and very quickly figure out what's going on with the project, because if it's a good project, they'll have lots of numbers in there. If there's no numbers, that's a red flag. Okay, any other questions on the executive summary? The table of contents, I think, is self-explanatory. You only need to go down to the first level headings and the second level headings. If you want to go down to third level headings, that's fine too, but most of these documents can be written with two levels of headings. Yes?
That's like being quick audit, right? The section format?
I think in this one, the page numbers are hyperlinked.
Yeah.
I don't remember if the sections are hyperlinked. Yeah, sections are hyperlinked too, yeah. In terms of, you can hyperlink any text just by swiping it and then doing insert.
Well, the easy way is to build the table of contents from the text.
Yeah, I mean, you can, this particular table of contents doesn't use the word auto generator, but you can build this automatically from the text. But whenever you do a cross reference, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the text, but these are basically cross-references. And when you do a cross-reference, you have a little box you can click, which says hyperlink it, and then it'll make it as a hyperlink. Okay, we've talked a lot about the problem statement, so I don't know that I need to say a whole lot more about that today. Are there any questions on the problem statement? Again, you know, two pages following the formatting guidelines. Minimum of two pages. By now, your problem statement should be more like 4 or 5 pages. You can put subsections in the problem statement if you feel like it's getting a bit long. That's allowable. What will I generally not see in the problem statement? Let's go back to the abstract for a second. What will I not see in the abstract? What are some of the things I will not see in the abstract?
Pictures.
Formulas.
Tables.
What about references?
No references.
Abstracts generally, even though technically you could say they should because you're oftentimes citing things, typically abstracts don't have references. What not? So contrast that with what should I see in the problem statement? What's one of the first things I should see in the problem statement? Lots of references. You didn't invent this stuff. You're using other people's work. So the problem statement is a prime target for plagiarism because most of what you're talking about has come from other sources. Pictures in the problem statement are good. And I didn't give those in the template, but you know, pictures are always good ways of getting points across. You can do tables and things. But generally, we want 2 pages of text. So, you know, if you put a half a page picture in there, that doesn't count. Because there's a lot to talk about in the problem statement, especially at this point in the class. Okay, design requirements. That's the assignment due next week. What are the two major pieces of the design requirements section? What goes in the design requirements section?
An
Well, first of all, you have the tables, right? You're going to have these two tables of technical and practical design constraints. The tables, again, should be formatted as shown with headings on the bottom and so forth. Now, the way I recommend doing these things, and this was something I know people struggle with a little bit, when I click on this, why do I get this box, this bigger box? What is that? That's a text box. And this table is actually inserted in a text box. Now, why do we do it that way?
Well, you don't have a run on the next page.
That gives you a lot more control over where this table appears. If you don't do that, if you just put the table in, Word's going to play a lot of mind games with you on splitting the table across pages and floating it and all this kind of stuff. This allows you to have a pretty good control over where the table appears in the text, but it still allows the text to go around the table. So your tables and figures should all be inserted inside of text boxes. You'll also notice that the caption is inserted inside the text box. Word 2010 may change this, and they're trying to get you to do captions as a separate object. You know, I don't get it. I don't do it. I undo it every time Word does it. I think it's better just to put them inside the same text box. So in addition to these two tables, so what are we looking for in the design constraints? In the table itself, when I read those design constraints, what are we looking for? What? Numbers. Again, they have to be quantitative. They have to say things like, you know, 10 dB, 15 dB, you know, quantitative things. They cannot be general things like it will work well or it will, you know, pass its test or it will be light. Now, what about the narrative? The second part of this design constraint section is the narrative. What is the purpose of the narrative? To explain the constraints. How do you go about explaining the constraints?
Make up a lot of stuff.
Make up a lot of stuff.
Dumb it down a little bit.
Dumb it down? No.
Talk about codes.
What?
Talk about codes, where they came from, how they were generated.
The narrative of the design constraints, would you say that's heavily influenced by the problem statement or by the approach? How many people say approach? Thank you. How many people say problem statement? Oh, a lot of people have no opinions. What else could there be? What?
One of the people on the chat says problem statement.
Right. Why do the design constraints narrative, why does it come from the problem statement? Okay, can you expand on that a little bit?
No.
So, here's a constraint. This system's classification rate will not exceed 3.5% on data which is 15 dB. You don't really need to know technically what that means. But what should you be thinking when you read that? If you were a project manager and a company gives you this proposal and they plop that on your desk and say, this is what we're going to build for you, what's your question going to be? What's your first question going to be? Well, more than likely, this was going to be in the document you gave that organization to write the proposal, because you're the one who actually set these. But when we read your senior design documents, what are we thinking when we read those numbers? How did you get those numbers? Does the application or the problem dictate that this is the right level of performance? If you can set this really easily, then you can build a very simple system and pass. But the problem statement is going to determine what this is. Now, where is this number going to come from in the problem statement? How do we as evaluators, what are we looking for when you declare to us that your system is going to do this 3.5%?
What was in the past?
Could you be more specific?
What was the number of other people, what they...
Other people, what they got. Thank you. Very good. That. And they're one of the teams that actually got asked that question in many, many meetings, so that's why they know that. But state of the art means this number should reflect what state of the art, what's common in the market you're trying to deal in.
And you ought to be able to tell us why, which one of those you have.
Now notice that he did not say anything about how you're actually going to do this project yourself. It's totally devoid of approach. Because this is what you're going to be designing to, and your approach is going to be influenced by these numbers. So I think that's an area we need to see some improvement this semester, because now you know enough about your projects and about the other technology you're dealing with to come up with some very realistic explanations of these things. But when we read this, we look to the problem statement. We don't look to the approach.
The other thing I want to point out is because you're going to tell us these things in the narrative, you don't have to put every single aspect of it in.
Yes, yes. Thank you. How long should these entries be? One sentence. Maybe two. But mostly one sentence. Statements of fact. It is what it is. Not, my grandmother said, you know, yesterday that, and on and on. Because in a narrative, you're going to explain why this is a reasonable number, why that's relevant to your project, and all that kind of stuff. Now, you know, I know you think, oh, this is all this writing stuff, and I want to be an engineer. But this is what engineering is. The bulk of your time as engineers are going to be spent arguing about these numbers written on paper, not spent at the bench actually building something, or out in the field actually taking data. I would say at this point, so that's actually a good question. In industry, in the real world, in industry, at this point in a project, let's say you come back to me as the project manager and say, we need to change the design constraints. What am I going to make you do? No. What you're going to do, where are guys from NASA? How would this be handled in NASA? But what are the mechanics of that? You're just going to change the document and not tell anybody? And what happens? There's going to be a formal revision document. And you're going to actually log these. All your documents will have version numbers, and it'll all be logged in a great amount of detail, because at this point, changing a specification in a project like this is a very serious issue. Why? Let's say you're paying somebody to build this thing for you, and you as a project manager are managing this document, and the vendor comes to you and says, I want to change the design constraint. Why are you going to sort of get that down in blood, in writing? Because what's the other side of that they're not telling you? It may mean that there's technical problems with what they were building before, but this is going to translate in a very real way, because what they're going to hit you with later is what's called a cost overrun. They're going to turn around and say, because you changed the specifications, you have to give us more money. And many of you will be in this situation because these specs are always, the vendors are always trying, your contractors are always trying to change this kind of stuff on you. So it's a big deal at this point. I mean, you can say these have been vetted through various reviews and they are somewhat set in stone. If you want to change them, get your course coordinator involved and sit down and go through them and make sure your course coordinator signs on the dotted line that this is fine. And most of the time they will, but... If you're definitely not going to make the constraint? Okay, so let's talk about that. That's another good question. What happens when at the end of the semester you come to us and say we met 100% of our design constraints? You get an A?
You're going to pick it apart.
You get the wrath of the coordinating committee. We will sit as a group and try to pick that sucker apart. Why? You didn't set your goals ambitious enough. It's okay to miss a constraint. I would expect all projects would miss at least about 20% of their constraints. That means their constraints were probably set very realistically. If you hit 100% of them, they were set too easily. If you're on a research project, you know, some of you will work in research, some will work in advanced development, some will work in productization. In research, what percentage of projects do you think are successful at the end? 10%? Less than 10%. The founder of Google once said, I want to start 1,000 projects so that I make sure at least one of them comes out good. Google has a lot of cash. Most research labs operate somewhere in the 2 to 5% area. Research is risky. It's speculative. You expect it to fail. In advanced development, probably about 25 to 50% of the projects are successful because now it's been proven in research, and now you're really just trying to productize it. In the productization world, you know, much higher percentage, maybe 75, 80% of the projects are successful. You never get everything right the first time. Now, when you miss a design constraint, okay, so what's the other piece of this? Oh, I'm being so nice, he's letting us miss 20% of our design constraints. When you miss a design constraint, what do we look for? Chris? No? What do you mean understanding of it? You analyze it. And you explain why your design did not meet that design constraint. This is what we call evidence of design. If you can explain to me and really convince me that there was a very good reason you missed that design constraint, and that if you had a chance to redesign this thing, these are the changes you would make, that's fine. That's perfect. That's wonderful. You get what senior design is all about. If you missed a design constraint because your parts came in late, that's not acceptable. I don't think we had last semester was my first senior design 2 projects. I don't think any one of them had a good reason why they missed their design constraints. It was really disappointing, as were their grades. Okay, so you've got through design constraints, the narrative, everything is set. Now we hit the approach section. What is the point of the approach section? How you're going to accomplish the designing of your project. How are you going to design your system, right?
Yeah.
This is not as Dr. Cohen has so often talked about, this is not a narrative on how you spent your summer vacation. This is a description of your project much like you would expect to read in a textbook if you had bought a textbook for one of your classes on this material. Textbooks are really good at describing things in ways that you can understand. They do that by breaking the problem down into a lot of smaller pieces. Your approach should read like a textbook. Pick up any one of your advanced engineering textbooks. That's what we're looking for in these approach sections. What typically do you find in one of your textbooks when you're reading on an engineering topic? What are some of the mechanisms textbooks use to explain to you, to teach you a topic? Tables, figures, equations, what else? References. How many references, if you read a chapter in one of your textbooks, how many references will you find? If it's a really good textbook, you may find 100 references at the end of each chapter. If it's a lighter textbook, you may find fewer, but generally you should find at least 20, 30 references per chapter. That's why for senior design, you know, we expect to see 50 to 100 references. If this was a research proposal, and some of you will have a chance to write those kinds of documents, I sit in panels where one of the first things people do is they look at the references. One of the first things reviewers do, I love when they do this. Not only do they look at the references, why is a reviewer looking at the references? If they're reviewing your proposal, whether it's research or development. One of the things they're looking for is how many times you cited their work. God help you if you quote their work and you don't reference them. I've seen that happen, and I've seen projects get killed because of that. I've seen people get accused of stealing other people's ideas because of that. So, references are very important. What format do we use for references? APA, not numeric. Some of you, a couple documents, I think, still had numeric references. We're using APA. And APA are nice. The one nice thing about APA are you don't have to cross-reference them in a document. What does it mean to use APA? Roughly, you're going to have an author, one or two other authors. If it's more than two authors, you're probably going to use that all, comma, the year, and you're going to have that in parentheses. That's a requirement. That's not optional. How do I find that reference in your reference list?
The hyperlink?
No. If I go read your reference list, where am I going to look for that reference? Armony and Dolan. Where am I going to look for that in your reference list? I'm going to look in the A's of your reference list, which means your reference list is going to be sorted alphabetically. That's part of the APA requirement. What if this guy Dolan has written three papers in the same year that you're referencing? How do you deal with that? Dolan's written three papers in 2002 by himself, and you want to reference them. You can't say Dolan 2002 because you don't know which one you're referencing.
Can you say
what?
Can you say more than
you? No. You just do A, B, C, D in lowercase after the year. So you'll see 2002 A, 2002 B, 2002 C. So how are we going to begin the approach section? What's the first thing we're going to look for? Okay. No, you just reference the author and the year. And then in the reference, you don't have to reference the page that you actually got it from. They used to do more of that. I don't know. This is one of those things that seems to be falling by the wayside over time. I personally think when you reference a textbook, it's nice to if someone actually puts where in the textbook they got that from. But over time, that's kind of lost. Okay? Any other? So what's the first chunk of the approach section? What's it going to contain? This is a quiz to see who was listening earlier. block diagram. The reason we had you do these block diagrams is we expected those to appear at the front of your approach section. We kind of thought, I thought that was obvious. I learned my lesson. It's a requirement now. Why, as Dr. Cohen mentioned, the block diagram is critical because it shows us how you're decomposing your big problem into smaller pieces. And I guarantee you, if you're struggling with your block diagram, you're struggling with decomposition of your project. So, the first chunk of the approach section is going to be an explanation of your block diagram. The following sections of the approach section are probably going to relate to the blocks in that block diagram. I'm sorry, Dick?
And the connections.
Yeah, there's different theories, but one way or the other, I'm going to be able to look at the structure of your approach section and map that to your block diagram very easily. What are some of the things you have to cover in your approach section? Let's say your project, we can pick a project. Let's say your project involves generating electricity from some solar cells. What are some of the things I'm going to be looking for in the approach section? Okay, no answers because you don't know how solar cells work, or no answers because you don't know how to write documents. All right, let's start. Maybe should we go with something simpler? Yes. Okay, let's talk about your job is to bake a cake. All of our software design sessions in my group evolve around what we call recipes, so we talk about cooking a lot. So you're going to make a cake. That's your senior design project. You're going to make this really good cake. What are some of the things I'm going to expect to see discussed in the design document? If this is an engineering document. Thank you. Yes.
But then do you have to talk about the science of how a cake gets baked?
It does somewhat depend on the scope of the project. And we certainly don't want you rehashing a lot of stuff that exists in the literature. You can just cite that and reference it. But if your senior design project evolves around, you've got some great new way to make a cake, and it's going to taste really, really good. What are some of the science I'm going to expect to see in the approach section? What a lot of your approach sections are missing are the science, the fundamental science that describes and governs your design. And at some point in your approach section, you're going to distill this to distill your project to a set of design equations. And you're going to show us how your outcome, like this great tasting cake, is a direct result of parameters you've chosen in these design equations. So for example, let's say the cooking time is somehow you've uncovered the magic equation that says, you know, taste is 3.7 times cooking time. Or actually it might be like a quadratic function. 3.7 squared plus 2.6 times t plus 5. So it's like a quadratic. That would be really great. Why? Because then what you can do is you can find the optimum point of that quadratic, and that's your operating point. That's, you're going to decide to cook for 37 minutes because that maximizes this equation that relates taste to cooking time. That's the science we want to see in these documents. Now, if you're doing solar conversion, I'm going to expect to see some discussion about how solar cells work, because more than likely your project is addressing efficiency of solar cell conversion, and you're going to be fiddling with the efficiency at the fundamental level. Now, what are some of the other things in this making a cake that we're going to expect to see in this document? What are the, there's sort of two general types of things you need to know about when you make a cake. Excellent. Exactly. You're going to certainly go through all the ingredients. You may have a section on each. You may talk about, I was watching some Chinese noodle maker the other day on CNN, and he's a master noodle maker, and he has a particular flour that he likes for his noodles, and he was explaining in great detail why he likes that flour. And he had to use that flour, kind of interesting how he explained that, why. You're going to explain the ingredients. That's one whole group of things you have to talk about. What's the other group of things you have to talk about? What's the hardest thing about cooking, in my view?
The order of tasks.
How you kind of put the process. What you mix when, how you mix it. And again, you're going to have all sorts of theory about that. This is what your approach section should look like. And I think we have a lot of work to do on the approach sections. So if you have questions specific to your project, meet with your course coordinators and talk to them about this. The last major section is in your approach, in addition to having the block diagram, what do I expect to see towards the end of your approach, since this is your major section on design? Certainly I'll see schematics, but what about after that? You did an assignment at the beginning of this semester that I expect to see in these documents, and that was what? Bill of materials and the cost analysis. The ending part of your approach, once you've explained how it works and everything and what you're going to do, should be the cost analysis. You should also have a section on schedule. We haven't quite stressed that as much, but the senior design teams coming up now are doing Microsoft project schedules for their projects, and that will be in their design documents. So once you get past approach is by far the biggest section in the document. Once you get past approach, you've got basically the testing section. So what are we going to expect to see in the testing section? Test specifications, which describe what? What? Testing what? For what? The design constraints, thank you. You're going to describe the tests you're going to perform to prove that you met your design constraints. It's very important that your test specifications trace back to your design constraints. You're going to describe your tests in great detail. This is a case where I don't mind a little bit of what I did for my summer vacation. I don't mind seeing test specs that say things like, take this wire and put it here and measure this. Use this piece of equipment, specifically naming the equipment. Because it's difficult to replicate tests, so as much detail as possible is a good thing. There was a question? So be very specific. Think of it as a lab manual. I should be able to run that test for you from what's in your test specification. And trust me, in the lab, you want to give me specific instructions. So once you've done the test specs, there's three types of tests I'm expecting to see after that. They are And these all relate to the design cycle. The first set of tests you're going to report on are what? Simulations, right? For those projects that have a simulation component, the first rounds of tests are going to be your simulations. Those hopefully were done last semester. What's the second set of tests?
Hardware.
Which hardware?
Prototype.
The prototype. Why the prototype? Why doesn't the project end with the prototype? Because the prototype usually doesn't work completely, or it doesn't meet all of your design constraints. So I expect to see testing on the prototype, and then I expect to see testing on the final version of the hardware. Those three need to be in there. If your project doesn't have a simulation component, that's okay. And I know testing varies somewhat from project to project, but most of the projects in this room should have those three components to their test section. Yes?
This might just be specific to my project, but we had to do testing kind of in order to define some of our constraints, but that don't affect our constraints. So how do you want us to include that in detail, or just mention that we did a certain test just for water quality?
Well, I think that's where this revisionist history concept comes in. You don't have to, we can maybe talk about that offline, but you don't, generally, you don't have to justify how you got to your design constraints. But you can then use those tests you described in your test section as a sort of a first round of preliminary tests. Yep.
Hyperlinks for the photos and equations and figures.
Okay, let me say one quick thing about the last few things. Summary and future work. What's the point of this section? Two things need to be in the summary and future work. Summary and future work. What? Why? Why? No. More important than interesting.
People will actually use this project to go further on some of the projects.
What is summary? What's a good summary section? So you've missed 20% of your design constraints. What's a good summary section? A good summary section sort of justifies that. Revisits, explains in summary what happened, why it happened, and that. Why the future work section is geared towards people who want to take this project and build on it. You're going to suggest if you had to do this all over again, there's a lot of things you would do differently, and every one of the projects has a long list of those issues. That goes in the future work. That's really important because there will be teams in the future picking up these projects. Some of you are working on competitions where every year there's a new, the competition is more or less the same, but new approach. And we've had problems in the past with students not getting access to the previous work. Some of you have picked up projects where the authors failed to talk about all the problems, and as you got into those projects, you realized it was a lot harder than what was being shown on the YouTube video because they didn't talk about any of the real problems. And now you're having to rediscover what that previous team learned, and that's just not the way engineering works. We always try to build on what's been done previously. Acknowledgements. Please write a nice, I've talked about this before, even if your advisor was an idiot and didn't help you at all, please write a nice paragraph thanking them and saying all sorts of good things about them. This is the way it's done in the real world. I'm sorry. The first thing your advisor is probably going to look at, if they ever look at this document, is the acknowledgement section. Trust me. Say something nice about them.
This could be borderline great.
Exactly. So let me say something about cross-references. I want to refer to equation one here. And or figure 1 or table 1, why don't I just type in figure 27, literally just typing, we show the relationship between X and Y?
Because on the last day, before this is due, you'll have 3 people editing the document. And they'll be all over the place.
And they'll cut some. They'll put something in before your text and after your text. And figure 27 will become figure 30. And you will forget about that because you wrote that section 3 months ago and haven't looked at it since. And you will forget to proofread that and make sure that when you're saying figure 27, it's the right figure 27. And that document will land in our laps and it'll be obvious because we're reading it for the first time and we're looking at figure 27. So you use cross-references so all of this stuff is updated automatically. I cannot stress this enough because I've done a lot of group document development in my career. So how do we refer to figure 1? How do we create a cross-reference here towards figure 1? We go to insert, we go to cross-reference, we look for the right heading, the right paragraph style, which is going to be figure. We select label and number only, and we insert. And it puts figure 1 in the text as a complete cross-reference. So if figure 1 becomes, you know, then that will be updated automatically as things move around in the document. Figures, tables, anytime you say, see section 3. Section 3 will be section 5 by the time you're done with this document. Anytime you refer to anything, it's cross-referenced. Anything like that, it's cross-referenced. That's absolutely essential or your document's going to break when you put it all together. And you will spend hours editing all these things. When it comes time to figure out how to do formats for your equations, formats for your templates, are you going to do a PhD on equation formatting? No. You're going to use the format painter and just copy the format. Now, equations are a little bit tough. I can show you that offline. That gets a little tedious, but... Okay, any other questions on this? This is it. I mean, you can still come to my office, but... So, zero tolerance for formatting issues this semester. Okay, so we will see you next week.